The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on The Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.
Bob McCullough is one of the longest-serving elected officials in St. Louis County's storied history. He's developed a reputation that's brought respect from people across the political spectrum and strong opposition from local and national activist groups. The Democrat joins us on another edition of Politically Speaking to talk about his bid for re-election and what he thinks about his primary opposition. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, a candid conversation with the Show Me State's biggest political newsmakers.
I'm Jason Mirzenbaum.
And I'm Joe Manish.
Elections should be about your accomplishments. What have you done to qualify you for the position, and why are you qualified to run?
I'm going to push back on these regulators.
I'm doing this for the people.
I was encouraged along the way, not just by my family, but by a lot of teachers and professors, and knew when I was in college that I would run for office someday.
We're very excited about the prospect of having some more free market solutions.
Even though after the conversation, I still might not agree.
We want our listeners to get a real sense of what drives these people.
They're actually people with a story to tell.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, Jason Mirzenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in our St. Louis studios today is
Rachel Lipman, another public radio reporter.
And
colleague Joe Manis.
And returning to our show for the first time since 2015.
Wow. where does the Jason keeps track of this.
Where does the time go? He's running for re-election as St. Louis County Prosecutor. Our guest is
Bob McCullough.
Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me back. You should do it more often.
We should every 3 years. And I mean this right before we're going to pepper you with hostile questions. Your 2015 appearance was, I think, one of the best politically speakings we've ever done.
Yeah, and it actually got a huge listenership.
Because you provided a lot of details and context behind the Darren Wilson, Michael Brown decision, which I highly recommend that people listen to, because we're not going to relitigate that case today. We want to talk about why you're running for re-election and sort of the politics surrounding it.
Some of the new controversies. Well, there's been a few since.
There's always controversies.
No, well.
Really?
I haven't heard any. I haven't heard any.
So, there's never controversies in politics.
I'll start off with a pretty basic question. Why did you decide to run for re-election? I think that there was kind of an unknown. You've been in office since 1991. You could have retired and made a lot more money in the private sector, and also provided St. Louis County with the inevitable Jake Zimmerman-Scott Sifton mega feud. But we'll have to wait for that till 2022. Why did you decide to run again?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. One, I love the job. I still love going to work every day. And I think we do a lot of good for a lot of people. And over the years, if I look back, and when I look back, and I hope others look back that same way, to see how that office has been transformed in the 28 years that I've been there. A lot of that dealing with, you know, other programs that we've started, enhanced, done a lot of things over the years in terms of keeping people out of jail or out of the system altogether. The changes in technology, changes in the law, of course. You know, we redid the entire criminal code, recodified it, if you will, several years ago. That project lasted a lot of years before we even brought in anybody else. It was the Prosecutors Association, and then brought in a lot of others, and ended up with legislators and public defenders, judges, everybody, all the stakeholders. And then it sat for 2 years before it became effective, so that you kind of see how things work. So there are a lot of moving parts, and still a lot of moving parts. The changes in technology that we have. And of course, we still have crime. And, you know, the prosecutor's primary function is to, especially on violent crime, target violent criminals and get them out of the neighborhoods and keep our streets safe. Part of it is that I've assembled, I think, an incredible staff over the years, you know, and part of it made it a possibility to make this a career. You can make more money in private practice. Anybody can. And if you're cut out to be a prosecutor, now, at least in St. Louis County, you can make a career out of it. You can stay there for a long time, and that's what I hope a lot of people will do, and a lot of people have. So there's a lot going on still that we want to get accomplished.
Give me an example of some of those new programs that you've used that you think really have been transformative in a way, and are those ones you would continue if you get an eighth term?
Sure. Well, I would start with this, and I leave this out a lot, and I don't know why, not intentionally, but I started out as an assistant prosecuting attorney, and I was an assistant for a little over 7 years. And
now, this was in the 80s?
Ended in the 80s.
Okay, okay.
Started in the 70s. Okay. I started in 1978. I'd spent a little time as a clerk for Judge Joe Stewart on the Court of Appeals, and then was hired by St. Louis County Prosecutor's Office in 1978. And I left in 1985 for the reason, and that was one of the reasons coming back, I wanted to make it a place where you could stay. You just couldn't afford to be a career prosecutor. That is what I wanted to do. And I tried an awful lot of cases then, well over 75 then, and since then, you know, going back as the elected prosecutor, I've tried a number of cases. So we're somewhere around 100 felony jury trials. And I think that experience did a lot of things. Number one, the time that I was there as an assistant prosecutor, you know, we could see different things that we would all like to do. I'll fast forward just a little bit there. When I left in 1985, Buzz Westfall, who was our prosecutor at the time, in 1990 decided to run for county executive. And that was an opportunity then. I thought, well, I may be able to get back into prosecution. It always bothered me that I wasn't there. Not that I didn't enjoy the people I worked with, but so I ran, as did a whole lot of other people. And by the time we got down to the actual election in 1990, there were four people running. All four of us had been assistant prosecutors in the office. Three of us had been there at the same time. Over the same time.
Yeah, I remember that contest very well.
And then, and we all had, in fact, my opponent in the general election, eventually, I won the primary, my opponent in the general election,
Ray
and
Grinder.
I had been, no, that was Tom Meehan then.
Tom Meehan then. Oh, that's right.
And
that's
Tom
right.
And
Grinder
I,
was later.
Yeah, yes. Tom and I had been roommates in the prosecutor's office during our time as assistants. So we all knew the job very well, and we all had ideas as to how we wanted to reshape the office, things that we wanted to do. And one of mine was, which I did pretty much as soon as we got there, was bring the victim advocates inside the prosecutor's office. So established a victim service unit within the office, and we brought in people we had been working with who were an outside agency. It was actually the National Council of Jewish Women, worked with them to make that transfer into the prosecutor's office and have expanded that ever since. And the most recent expansion, we added a new, I guess I'll call him an employee, Levi, our new support dog. Duo trained this dog for 2 years, and I'm sold on it now. I saw him at work. Is probably not a good description, but he sat with one of our child sex abuse victims, and you could just see this kid just relax and open up after having done a three-hour deposition on some of the most horrifying things that you can imagine. So those sort of things that we just kind of keep expanding as we go. We've expanded over the years, increased the services that are available. I started along with a couple of judges, the drug court almost 20 years ago, which has been very successful. We've treated successfully an awful lot of people. You know, if you check with OSCA, you'll see that ours has been one of the most, if not the most successful drug courts in the state of Missouri.
And how many are in the drug courts on a given year? Your opponent mentioned some statistics, and I want to make sure that we clarify what the actual number is.
Well, I'm glad, because I was getting to that. I've heard those numbers, and they jump all over, and they're kind of magical numbers that he talks about. At any given time, there's somewhere around 75 to 80 or so active participants in drug court. And there's no set number of that, but we keep it around that number in order to be able to effectively provide services to all 75 or 80 or however many happen to be there at that particular time, because it is incredibly expensive for each one. And if you spread it out too far, we could double it tomorrow. That would be easy. But then each one of them would get half of what they're getting now, which is not effective, and we're doing nobody any good at all. So it's a constant struggle for funding for that. So the drug court team gets together, and you know, obviously it starts in the prosecutor's office because that's where the cases come in, and we will screen cases and send them to the drug court team with a recommendation. Judges may send other cases over. Probation and parole may have people that they want coming in, and the team consists of the prosecutor, defense attorney, probation and parole, the judge, and the treatment providers who are probably the most important aspect of that, along with the probation and parole people, because we kind of keep everything on track with that, and they're the ones in charge of the treatment. You know, obviously, prosecutors aren't going to be treating people for a drug addiction. We all do our separate part in that. And so that's a number on it. And we've had, you know, I've heard talk about 36 people successfully completing. Well, we had a graduating class just about a month or so ago that had almost 36 people in it. And that happens about every 6 weeks. And I always encourage everybody, and I encourage all of you, to attend one of those graduation ceremonies sometimes, because you will see just how important these courts are. And the end result is then, you know, they successfully complete that. It's a minimum 15 months. Then the plea of guilty they entered is withdrawn, and I dismissed the case. And that was actually one of the sticking points at the outset, because I wanted to do it that way. Some of the judges wanted to do it without a plea, and some, you know, and that. So it took a little bit to kind of work out some of the details. But the real key is this, that once it's successfully completed, it's like it never happened. That case is withdrawn, or the plea is withdrawn, set aside, and the case is dismissed like it never happened. Adding to that and expanding on it, and they're essentially run in the same manner, are a veterans court, because they have the same sorts of issues. But they're veterans, and the good news is we're able to partner with the VA, and the VA provides all of the treatment services, and so we can get as many in there as we can. One of the smartest things that somebody did, I don't know who it was, but they deserve a lot of credit, is that they suggested that we have mentors come in. You know, there isn't anybody who can understand what a combat veteran has gone through fully unless they're a combat veteran, and that works wonders, because these fellows will open up, you know, with someone who understands fully what they're talking about. And that has been also a very successful program. We also do mental health docket. It's not a separate court, but, you know, people with relatively minor crimes who have mental health issues, and try to, you know, make sure that we're keeping them out of the system. They're not real desperados, but trying to keep them out. The same with DWI court. You know, we'd much rather treat and have a sober driver on the street than just, you know, put somebody in jail for a short time and they're going to be back out on the street. We all know that. So in the past, the only way to keep them from driving drunk was to keep them confined. And, you know, we know that doesn't work. Most people who get a DWI never come back into the system. But if we see somebody the second time, it increases the odds that we're going to see them the third time. And if we see them the third time, we know they're coming back the fourth time. And so that's the whole purpose of the DWI court, is to break that cycle there and treat the addiction like we treat any other drug addiction, and get them back on. And it's a lifelong concern, because they're never, obviously you have to work at it after that. And a lot of the, whether it's drug court, DWI court, or one of the others, they come back and they continue their counseling, and some come back and mentor. So
are there any records as far as how many people have gone through these programs?
Sure.
I mean, like you mentioned, there was 36 through the drug court this one last recent graduation, but are there any totals, like either since it's been
sure
in operation? And the same with some of the others, so that we have right. Some
yeah, you can go to OSCA. OSCA is in charge of all the drug courts, the administration. That's the
Office of State Court Administrators.
Good, I'm glad you said. I always get it wrong. And they have that. You may have to search for it a little bit, but they have all of those numbers in there, and they break them down by circuit. And ours is a single county circuit, so everything deals with St. Louis County.
21st, if anyone is curious.
I get that one wrong usually, too.
Well, I wanted to ask you about something else. You mentioned about the pay for your staff, which is a legitimate challenge.
Sure.
One of the things I think the layman, non-lawyers don't understand, it's often hard to convince somebody to stay in a prosecutor's or sure public defender's office, because you can make 10 times as more money in the private sector. Maybe not 10 times,
but yeah,
depending,
maybe not 10,
depending but... how good of a lawyer you are, it's significantly more money.
Sure.
How much did Prop P affect your ability to pay your staff more? And because that's actually gotten some criticism from the county council, but I could also see it being a recruitment tool to get lawyers to not only join your office, but to stay for a while.
Well, and there's no question that that is what occurred because, you know, not just the lawyers, and I wish it could have been expanded to the entire county, all the county employees, but, you know, Prop P was designed to enhance public safety by providing funds for a variety of things, not the least of which were salary for additional bodies and to adequately compensate the people who are already there, whether they're police officers or prosecutors. And so with that, I was able to get a raise and a substantial raise because like all employees, none of the county employees have had any real raise for a number of years. So able to get a significant raise for the people who had been there some time, and we based it on, among other things, the number of years of service. So that we could break that. You know, I was hiring people at who were making, the day they walked in, the exact dollar amount that someone who had been there 5 years was making. And that just isn't right. You know, there's no motivation. It lessens that. Fortunately, we had a lot of dedicated people. So I was able to raise that salary for the people who were there and raise it based upon the number of years they'd spent there. So a guy who's been there 5 years, he's going to get more than the guy who's been there 4 years and on down. That also allowed me to raise the starting salary. So, you know, I was able to raise a starting salary for an assistant prosecutor to $60,000. Now, that's a lot. That was a huge increase. We were paying under 50 for that, and there's room to advance on that. People have been there a while. So we have about 63, I'd say, prosecutors right now. There's always a vacancy here and there, you know, people are that large. But if we were classified with law firms, we'd be, I'm sure, in the top 10 in size in law firms. Well, the big firms certainly still pay a lot more starting salary for that. And we're always competing with big firms, and we're competing with corporations who pay a lot more. But it's not uncommon for somebody to leave one of those firms and come to work for the prosecutor's office because that's the work that they like, that's what they want to do, and now they can stay, and that's been great. It also enabled me to add 7 new prosecutors and, for the first time, a public information manager so that we can do a better job of getting information out.
Now, there's been some controversy in the county council. This has been going on for months because there have been a few apparently in the Justice Center who didn't get the raises. B, particularly the nurses. Apparently there's about roughly 55 that mainly nurses who serve the prisoners. And although they're technically health department employees, they considered themselves, because they worked at the Justice Center, more Justice Center employees. The bottom line is they didn't get the big raises. There's a big controversy now because the council went ahead and awarded them the raises under Prop P, but Stanger says they need to be through the health department. He's not opposed to the raises, just where it's coming out of. You're kind of, I'm not sure if you've said anything about this. I'm just interested in your thoughts about the fact there were some people, I don't know if it was in your office or just in the Justice Center operation, who have not gotten the money, and then, of course, the nurses as well.
Well, in my office, everybody works for the Office of Prosecuting Attorney, whether they're investigators, victim advocates, support staff, you know, the legal secretaries that we have. And so everybody in that office participated in the raises that we're able to get through the Prop P money. I found it not a convincing argument to say that, well, they're neither police nor are they prosecutors, therefore they're not public safety. Well, you know, no office operates without the support staff. And so that was just kind of an argument that just didn't go anywhere with me. They are support staff for that. As I understand the argument with Justice Services is that nobody's quarreling about the raise. It's where it's coming from. So
Does
it come
from
the
health fund
or
the
health fund? So that's just.
So what are your thoughts? I mean, because Stanger's saying that he got pressure from the police not to pay the nurses out of Prop P. I mean,
Yeah, I never, I said all of my employees work for the prosecuting attorney. And so I've kind of watched that in the paper and on the news. And I know that, and it does seem to me that a raise is a raise. If I'm the one getting a raise, what do I care where the funding is coming from? So I'm not sure what the argument is. And, it, you know, hopefully they'll work that out.
I want to shift into the campaign dynamics a little bit. I was actually reading the paragraph for the last Politically Speaking that I would say before 2014, you were probably one of the most popular elected Democrats in the state. People like Claire McCaskill and Chris Koster actively sought out endorsements. I know you and McCaskill have been friends for a long time, so that probably wasn't a hard endorsement to get. After 2014 and the Michael Brown shooting, you became a national figure. Some people agreed with what happened. A lot of activist groups locally and nationally didn't. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about that on the last show. How do you think that's affecting this bid for re-election? Because typically your bids for re-election have been pretty easy. Yeah. This time it seems more competitive because some national groups may be getting involved because of the Darren Wilson decision. I'd like to hear your take on that.
Well, I think part of it, and I don't think there's a maybe getting involved on it. You know, the ACLU has jumped in. The ACLU made an expenditure of nearly $50,000 in June. And the report they filed in the Ethics Committee, with the Ethics Committee, is that it was to oppose the reelection of Robert McCullough. So, and now they're, I've heard they're running an ad on radio, at least, the ACLU is. I think it's probably in violation of a lot of regulations, but they are supporting a candidate and opposing another candidate. And even though they say, well, we're not supporting or opposing, say what you want. I mean, it's pretty clear that they're absolutely opposing that. So that has some impact on it. And the narrative that has picked up, particularly in the last year or so, is that, you know, we want to be more progressive and do things that keep people out of the system. And so I got a whole bunch of, in fact, that's what the document I prepared. I got a whole bunch of surveys from, basically the same survey from different organizations with a lot of overlap saying, you know, cash bails, you know, what are you going to do with cash bails? We want you to prohibit cash bails. Stop it immediately. Well, first of all, there's no alternative or suggestion or anything else. And so, but a lot of what they're talking about is we don't do and haven't done for as long as I can remember. I know they made a big deal out of Cy Vance in Manhattan, who said, I'm no longer going to seek a warrant or cash bail on misdemeanor cases. And that was a great thing. Well, we don't seek warrants or cash bail on, or any kind of a bail on misdemeanors, and haven't for decades.
But I take it you do for felonies, though.
Well, for some felonies, and lesser felonies, we don't. On drug cases, well, we don't want you know, getting warrants on drug cases. We don't. Mm-hmm. You know, the drug case comes in, and that's something else that evolved over that to make things work more efficiently is, everybody will probably find this hard to believe, but not everybody who sells you what they're telling you is heroin is actually selling you heroin. Sometimes it's not even a controlled substance. So when a case occurs, the police bring it into our office. We review it and say, all right, well, if this is heroin or whatever it happens to be, we'll file charges on it. So go get it analyzed at the lab. What that did is help the backlog at the lab, because before that, they were analyzing everything, and then they would bring it over to us. So we changed that a number of years ago. But even before that, or about that time, I changed the process that when we do decide that we're going to file the charge on that, the analysis comes back, and yes, it is a controlled substance. We do the same thing we do on misdemeanors. We send a summons to the individual and say, here's it. You know, we send it. The court sends it. It has a court date on it and says, show up on this court date. There is no warrant involved. There is no bond involved. So we do that not just on drug cases, but some of the other lesser felonies, some stealing cases, some other property crimes. And so a lot of the stuff that they're talking about, we do, but nobody bothered to ask and check that. So I prepared a document, which I provided to just about anybody and everybody, and sent it off to a lot of them to say, hey, you know, these are the things you're demanding. We've been doing them for years.
Can you give us like a, just a real quick summary? I mean, you mentioned cash bail.
Sure. Well, they and I did the drug offenses too. You know, we don't want locking up. We don't issue as a general rule, and that's part of it here too. Is that because every case we look at is looked at individually, and so rarely do we issue a standalone misdemeanor, particularly on a drug case. You know, those are generally handled in the municipal court where they ought to be, and some municipal courts handle them right and some don't. So we generally don't do that. And the same, like I said, with the drug-related offenses and the bail bonds. But when we look at other issues that we're talking about, we're second chances in that. You know, you really have to earn your way into prison in Missouri. And certainly in St. Louis County, you know, nobody goes to prison. It's a nonviolent offense. Nobody goes to prison on that first time. So they're going to end up with a probation their first time into the system. And in that probation, there's certain requirements and certain, and usually, hardly ever, does it involve any sort of shock time, jail time. So they get an SIS and
Suspended imposition. Right.
You're doing good
sentence.
With the acronyms really. Today.
Suspended imposition. There's no sentence imposed. And there are conditions of probation put on it that are specific. Some are generic, obey the laws, and some are specific to that particular individual and case. And they work with the probation office, and an awful lot we never see or hear from again once their probation is done. We also work years ago with the legislature, with the Pew Foundation. I was part of the committee that drafted the Justice Reinvestment Act that was enacted by Missouri, which created incentives and motivations for people to work there. You know, they go a month with no violations on probation, and a month gets knocked off of the length of the probation. And so it's just another incentive for for compliance with that and to keep people out of jail. So there are a lot of those things. And others, they're the diversion program. I talked about my diversion program. I think I did. But with the diversion program, we never file a charge. You know, if the individual successfully completes it, there's no charge ever filed. And so they have no record at all. And they're generally younger people. They're generally minor crimes, felonies, not misdemeanors. You know, so misdemeanor is a general rule. We don't pursue misdemeanors unless they're in conjunction with a felony. So we've done that. What else?
So how much of the narrative that's sort of out there is just that it's you as this national figure? I mean, are people just sort of deliberately missing this, or is it that you've been in office for 28 years and they don't believe that you have these programs in place?
And, you know, I wish I could answer that. I don't have a clue. That's something you're going to have to ask the ACLU. I provided them this to them, and I think they've adopted the philosophy that and some of their funders that, hey, anybody who's been there a long time is the problem, and therefore, you know, we're opposed to them, no matter what they're doing, and we don't even bother finding out what they're doing. But most prosecutors across the country, certainly in major urban areas, have very similar programs. You know, another one came up the other day. It was an assessment program for a risk factor on whether somebody gets released without a bond or with conditions, you know, and so there's a grant for that. I saw that one of the participants is a friend of mine, the prosecutor in Phoenix. I contacted him, talked with him a little bit about it, and he's getting back with me with some of the other pros and cons of the program, and it may be something that we apply for, and it may not be. It just so we're doing that constantly, and I think most prosecutors around do that, but you know, that narrative developed, and why, I couldn't tell you, but you know, the ACLU wants to pick the prosecutor and put their agenda in place, and that is strictly what this is all about, this particular election.
Well, one of the things I asked Wesley Bell is kind of a preemptive question, because his main experience in the prosecutorial and judicial realm is in the municipal arena, and some of the cities that he's been in don't have the best reputations.
Correct.
So I asked him about that, and his response was, and I'm sure you've heard this yourself, was
sure.
He thinks that you should have played a bigger leadership role in cleaning up a lot of the problems in the municipal courts over the years. I'm paraphrasing,
well,
but
I want
right. I know that you've been very critical, not only of some municipal courts, but also of some police departments that
sure.
have not had the best reputations. In addition to responding to that, I kind of want to get your vision about what you would do as prosecutor to make that situation better, because in my view, yes, some of the smaller cities in North St. Louis County clearly are problematic, but some of the larger ones in St. Louis County municipal courts, I think also have some problems too. I'd like to hear your take on this.
Well, I think if you take a look at it, first of all, and we'll talk about that. You know, Velda City was a prime example, and Mr. Bell was the judge in Velda City in 2013, 14, and part of 15. And the reforms he talks about implementing were done because he was ordered to do them, in terms of recalling warrants, in terms of dismissing cases. You know, he was the judge at a time when Velda City was one of the most predatory municipal courts that were up there, resulting in three different federal lawsuits. And the last one was, which was settled almost immediately, a young lady who was arrested on, you know, some minor charge and held in jail and would have lost that had a group not intervened and filed a federal lawsuit, which resulted in the changes that, you know, Mr. Bell wants to take credit for now. And shortly after that, Velda City had a new judge. You know, not a whole lot different in Riverview, for example, where, you know, he was sort of a part-time prosecutor. But that's kind of the full extent. When you talk to him in any detail, you realize that he has absolutely no idea what goes on in the circuit courts or in the prosecutor's office, and that's very dangerous for public safety because, you know, I heard him on one show talk about, well, you know, what do you think of this good Samaritan law? Well, I'd have to see the proposal and I'd have to do this, and maybe I could work for something like that, and, you know, something. Had no idea that Missouri enacted a Good Samaritan law a year and a half ago, and it's been in effect. And it's one that says, just something we never did in the first place. I worked with the authors of that to craft a few of the things and put it on there to say, hey, you know, if there's a drug overdose and you call the police or seek help for the person overdosing, you will not be charged with these relatively minor cases. You don't have to worry about that. You know, you can't be charged or arrested. So, no idea that that existed, and that's a complete inexperience. He has zero experience as a prosecutor, and translating from municipal prosecutor or municipal judge into the circuit system it's not the equivalent. My new prosecutors all start off doing what a municipal prosecutor does, and that's handling traffic matters and relatively minor other offenses, but primarily traffic matters. And they graduate from that and move on. They are certainly not going to become supervisors in the office, certainly not going to become someday, but they're certainly not going to be put in positions of now you're a supervisor because you've done a traffic docket. So those are the problems. I think even the American points out, the St. Louis American points out, is it just, you know, Mr. Bell's never reformed anything and was part of the problem in Velda City, certainly. So now they're not fond of me either, don't get me wrong. But
yeah, I don't think they're huge fans of you.
But at the same time, they make it very clear that, you know, this guy's got no experience and would be not good in there. They actually pat me on the back a little bit to say that, you know, I'm far more progressive in the area of calling out municipal courts and municipal departments that have abused this. And, you know, we've tried for years to get rid of some. And, you know, part of that is that, you know, the municipalities don't work for me. Police departments don't work for me. They don't work for the prosecutor. They don't work for the county. And so you can have some influence with that, but It's generally not going to go because that little fiefdom is there and it's going to stay in the ones that are abusing that. Now, most of the municipalities are just fine and always have been and, you know, always fine-tuning things. But the ones he's been associated with, none of them have and Ferguson is another one.
Now, the courts have knocked out some of what was known as SB5, which had a whole lot of reforms or changes dealing with these local courts in these municipalities. Have you been involved at all in either trying to get a replacement law in effect, or what do you think needs to be done at this point? Because you seem to be pretty well versed on what's passed or what's in effect from the state. What do you think needs to be done? And is there anything that your office can do or not?
Well, what the courts knocked out on Senate Bill 5, I think just about everybody knew was going to get knocked out, and had two sets of rules, one
right.
for St. Louis County and one for the rest of the state. You know, everybody, almost everybody knew that was not going to fly. And that's primarily what got knocked out. But in some, and I heard a state rep on my way down here today talking about that, you know, they need to back up a little bit on some of these things because now nobody shows up in court. There is no reason. And the police are not doing a lot of self-initiated activity.
You mean what? People just aren't showing up because there's no penalties?
Yeah, or? Because there's no penalty, but there's nothing that you can do if you don't show up. You know, you can't arrest them for what have been deemed minor traffic offenses. They can't be arrested. No one can be arrested. And that's, you know, a lot of different things, speeding under certain amounts and that. I don't practice in the municipal court, so I can't tell you all that. Ours, even traffic matters are state court violations, and we handle that. But I think there's a lot of work that has to be done, but that has to be done at the municipal level. And I think you have to look at the municipal officials that are there and see what they're doing. And if they're not doing it, then the legislature can do a lot with that. But, you know, in all candor, you know, we all have our bailiwick. And while I've tried to influence over the years, as far back as I can remember, and have said publicly that, look, some municipalities just shouldn't exist because they can't provide basic services. They need to do something about that because they're people. You know, their victims are... Their people are being victimized more than they should be, and sometimes by the municipal government. So,
how would you characterize your relationship with the General Assembly and the leaders, many of whom are Republicans?
You know, I work very well with the and even now with the General Assembly and with the leaders. And I met with the new Governor Parson. I've known him for a long time when he was a state senator, and then lieutenant governor, and now governor. And so. And he's a guy that you can work with, and he's got a great deal of experience, real world experience and real life experience, and others, you know, that, yes, there's a supermajority of reps and senators who are Republicans, but, you know, it gets to law enforcement and public safety. I think everybody thinks an awful lot alike. You want to protect the public, and it's a public safety issue, and so we work very well with the legislature.
Before we get into the fun world of county politics, I want to ask a similar question to what I asked Wesley Bell.
Sure.
I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that St. Louis City and St. Louis County merger talks could become more serious in the next 4 years. Mm-hmm. I'm interested to hear your philosophical thoughts about possibly bringing in the Circuit Attorney's Office to the St. Louis County's office if the St. Louis City joins as a municipality. I know that it's very vague and philosophical, but
that it is.
But I want to just hear your general thoughts of it, because when in this entire talk about merger,
right?
Oftentimes, like even the Post-Dispatch is like, well, St. Louis City can keep the Circuit Attorney's Office. I'm interested right. to hear your take on this.
I kind of look at and maybe it's the lawyer in me, but you know, a merger means there are two separate entities and one of them disappears. And so the first things first, we have to figure out what we're talking about, because some people want the city boundaries to be contiguous with the county boundaries. Others are talking about the city being a municipality within the county.
So it'd be number 89 right now.
Right now I think it would be, yes. And so, and then there are others who say, well, let's do this and then work out the details. I think that is absolutely disastrous there. That is a frightening thought. So I think some of these details have to be worked out first, and that is one of them, because you look at it, if there is one county, then there's one county prosecutor. And so what happens to the circuit attorney? Does it disappear? Are they now all county employees? And what about the elected circuit attorney, whoever that happens to be, whenever this happens, if it ever happens, you know, what happens to that position? So those are things that I think you have to work out. Let me give you another one that I think, and just in my bailiwick, my area of expertise is a jail. Maintaining a county jail is just what it sounds like, a county function. And so the city maintains a jail, which is a county function, because the city has city and county, or municipal and county functions. So what happens with that jail? The same as the prosecutor's office. is that jail now part of the county judicial system, and where does the funding for that go?
Hey, so, if the city became part of the county, it seems like it would be.
Well, it seems like it would be to me, too. And so does the mayor just say, here, Mr. Executive, here are the keys to the jail, whatever we use these days, and good luck? Or, yeah, those are the things that have to be worked out. You have to sit down and talk about it. And, you know, I've talked to you, I told Better Together before. I wasn't crazy about their idea of let's do it and be done with it and then work it out. But I'm more than happy and always have been to sit down and talk out some of the details on this. And there are a lot of things that that we need to talk out.
So your race is kind of going on amidst this very expensive county executive's primary between incumbent Steve Stenger and Mark Montevani. I don't know how much has been spent, but probably close to $30 quadrillion at this point.
I'm being facetious.
So I would say that there are two reasons Stenger is in office. The one is Charlie Dooley. His last term was a disaster, and I think that he is responsible for losing his election. So mm-hmm. I want to make that clear before I make my second point. I think that your endorsement of Stenger was very helpful for Stenger winning that primary and winning that election. Mm-hmm. And you appeared in some TV ads with him. And like it or not, you two are kind of connected politically sure. because of that. Sure. In recent months, some of Stenger's admittedly political adversaries, and I want to make it clear that these right. are people that do not like Stenger, have accused him of various pay-for-play situations with Northwest Plaza right. and other things. And Stenger has denied that he's done anything wrong. But it has brought up this question that I wanted to ask you. How can you effectively look into any allegations against a county executive that you basically ran with as a ticket without having to pine it off to some other prosecutor? I don't know if anyone has asked you to do that yet, but it seems like that's an obvious conflict. And if there is a situation that really does have some evidence to it, it seems like you're not really in a great position to look into it because mm-hmm. of your political relationship with Stenger. So I'd like to hear your response to that.
Well, let me do your first question first. That the first part about whether there'd be a conflict or not, and I think, and I've never hesitated in any situation in which there is a conflict to do exactly that. File a motion with the court and say, if there's something, appoint a special prosecutor. I've done that numerous times over the years that I've been in office, if there is a conflict. And so, of course, if there was a conflict, and first, nobody's ever suggested that. I've seen the ads, too, but nothing has ever, you know, been anything other than a political ad. So having said that, you know, there's really nothing to comment on. If something ever came to me on anybody, and it was a created a conflict, then obviously I would recuse myself, ask the judge to appoint a special, and if it didn't, then I would proceed in the manner in which we proceed. So
now
I think that probably would be one that would, you know, as I did with a councilman recently,
right.
that it created a conflict because of the situation that had just occurred. And so I did nothing on that case except tell the judge that I have a conflict and I'm recusing myself and you need to appoint a special prosecutor.
So. Well, you're often at county council meetings in the audience.
I was there for 5 months.
Well, I guess
not for
it's more than a lot of people though.
20 years before that.
Okay, no, but sense. I mean, I get my point is within the last year.
Right.
I mean, because I've often been able to run over in the audience and grab you on something out in the hall and say, such and such, I need your comment on this. Do you have any granted, you're not Stenger's advisor, but, you know, you do watch kind of what's going on. Do you have any general assessment you want to say about why it seems to be so acrimonious, even though in many cases these are fellow Democrats who are jumping on Stenger?
Sure. You know, I don't know. I gave up trying to explain people and their motivations many years ago. I have no idea. And obviously there is some friction there. But the origin of it, the reason for it, you know, some, no question, are political reasons for it. Others may be personal, but you know, it's not good, and it's not good for the county. And unfortunately, but, you know, when you have politicians, elected officials, sometimes it devolves into personal issues or political reasons. But other than that, I have no explanation.
I mean, one of the issues was your pension. I mean, without replaying it all, I think we need at least mention it.
They had voted to make
changes that would have increased the pension for whoever held this office.
Correct.
This time. Then they backtracked. And the key point is that in some ways that controversy over your pension was the kickoff of what's now been a fight in the General Assembly, in the County Council, almost every issue.
Well, I would slightly disagree with that. I think the kickoff was when Mike O'Meara lost re-election, when Ernie Trakas won. That was pretty much the kickoff to what we saw now. But continue.
Well, I think it did. I think that was the acrimony was building long before the pen. I think I simply, in that case, got caught in the crossfire.
The fuse.
It was an opportunity for a councilman or two to take a run at Stenger, and they jumped on it, and I'm just caught in the crossfire on it because the ones who were complaining the most signed off on it, agreed to it, passed it just a year before, and so with no objection, with no problems at all, and it took them 5 months to figure out how to undo what they did, and they finally figured it out. But
what was the impetus for changing your pension to begin with?
Well, to begin with, it was that there was, and keep in mind this, as I said repeatedly, it would be a change in compensation. And so even though it was in 2016, it was not going to have any impact on anybody until January of 2019, depending upon who wins the election in 2018. So, to say it was mine, I mean, I planned, believe me, on being the guy who's there on January 1 of 2019. But what occurred is there was just an automatic reduction in the prosecutor's pension, and nobody could ever find a real reason for that. Why is it there? It doesn't save the county any money. It didn't change anything else. It had no impact on the actuarial value. And so the pension board looked at it and recommended that it be repealed. And I had asked, no question, I had asked Councilman O'Meara, who said, I'll send it to the pension board, see what they think, which is what he did. Pension board looked at it, studied it, sent it back and said, we don't know why it's there, but we'd recommend that the council repeal it. So council got the legislation and repealed it.
So then going forward, you said you kind of got caught in the crossfire and it's not good for the county. How do you, as an office who is dependent on the county council to give you the money to operate the office, how do you kind of navigate what could be a 5-1, 6-1 spat and, protect what you need to do the office?
Yeah, because that's my fear as a new county resident. My fear is that it's going to get so bad that departments are going to stop functioning and normal county business is going to cease. Now, I know that's kind of hyperbolic, but I'm a bit concerned by that.
How am I the only city resident in the room right now?
There is a concern. I mean, if you look at what the council did last year, which is the real reason why I recused myself when
Ernie Trakas.
Issues came up is because they had just cut my budget by 13% and at the same time increased their own budget by a lot more than 13%, and that's became issues for other people. But so, it is a concern with that. And at the same time they cut it, they said, well, look, if that money's not there, then just come back and we'll do a subsequent appropriation. My office is all about public safety, and I will go to the mat on anything that anybody does that impacts negatively public safety. And if that's a battle that we have to, that's a battle that we will fight, and I think the public will be on the side of public safety every time with that, because it's going to impact them if the prosecutors can't prosecute violent criminals. If police can't put police on the street, it's gonna affect them. And I just can't imagine any responsible elected official allowing that to happen. But we'll certainly go to the mat on that.
Before we let you go, if you win re-election, Will this be the last election you'll ever be a part of, or can we start speculating that you're going to run for like lieutenant governor in 2022
or 2020? Ninth term, or
it's speculate all you want. It is incredible to me, to tell you the truth, that I ran in 1990 and said I have no intention of running for anything other than prosecuting attorney. And to this day, people say, "Hey, when are you going to run for this? Pick an office?" I had no intention.
Yeah, because that was a
no
big thing.
No intention ever of running for anything other than prosecuting attorney. This is the job that I want. I think in the 28 years I've been here, I've done, if I say so myself, a very good job, and not just in the work that we do, but in assembling a tremendous staff. And the experience that we have enables me to continue doing that. And I think on the other side of the coin, the other side of the ballot, is a complete lack of any experience, and I'm sure he's a fine guy and a fine lawyer, but putting someone with zero experience in a position like this would be one of those things I think is very detrimental to public safety. So
we think this is an important race. So sure. we wanted the voters of St. Louis County to get a good sense of who the two candidates are, and we appreciate your time. For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me at Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Rachel on Twitter at
R. Lipman, two P's, two N's.
Follow Joe on Twitter at
J. Manis, that's J-M-A-N-N-I-E-S.
And I actually think that your campaign has a Twitter account.
It has a Twitter, something I never thought I'd hear myself say. But start with BobMcCulloughSTL.com, and that has links to that's the webpage, and that has links to Twitter and Facebook. And
everything in between.
Yep.
All right, we'll be back next time. Until then, so long.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.